Chapter 19. There are only two proper ways to kill bulls with the sword and muleta, and as both of them deliberately invoke a moment in which there is unavoidable goring for the man if the bull does not follow the cloth properly, matadors have steadily tricked this finest part of the fight until 90 of 100 bulls that you will see killed will be put to death in a manner that is only a parody of the true way to kill. One reason for this is that rarely will a great artist with the cape and muleta be a killer. A great killer must love to kill. Unless he feels it is the best thing he can do, unless he is conscious of its dignity and feels that it is its own reward, he will be incapable of the abnegation that is necessary in real killing. The truly great killer must have a sense of honor and a sense of glory far beyond that of the ordinary bullfighter. In other words, he must be a simpler man. Also, he must take pleasure in it, not simply as a trick of wrist, eye, and managing of his left hand that he does better than other men, which is the simplest form of that pride and which he will naturally have as a simple man, but he must have a spiritual enjoyment of the moment of killing. Killing cleanly and in a way which gives you aesthetic pleasure and pride has always been one of the greatest enjoyments of a part of the human race. Because the other part, which does not enjoy killing, has always been the more articulate and has furnished most of the good writers we have had a very few statements of the true enjoyment of killing. One of its greatest pleasures, aside from the purely aesthetic ones, such as wing shooting and the ones of pride, such as difficult game stalking, where it is the disproportionately increased importance of the fraction of a moment that it takes for the shot that furnishes the emotion, is the feeling of rebellion against death which comes from its administering. Once you accept the rule of death, thou shalt not kill is an easily and a naturally obeyed commandment. But when a man is still in rebellion against death, he has pleasure in taking to himself one of the godlike attributes, that of giving it. This is one of the most profound feelings in those men who enjoy killing. These things are done in pride, and pride, of course, is a Christian sin and a pagan virtue. But it is pride which makes the bullfight, and true enjoyment of killing which makes the great matador. Of course, these necessary spiritual qualities cannot make a man a good killer unless the man has all the physical talent for the performance of the act, a good eye, a strong wrist, valor, and a fine left hand to manage the muleta. He must have all of these to an exceptional degree, or his sincerity and pride will only put him in the hospital. There is not in Spain today one really great killer. There are successful matadors who can kill perfectly, though without great style, when they wish, luck being with them, but who do not attempt it often because they do not need to in order to hold their public. There are matadors who might have been great killers in the old days, who started in their careers killing bulls as well as it could be done, but who, through their lack of ability with cape and muleta, early ceased to interest the public, and so have few contracts and lack the opportunity to develop their art with the sword, or even to keep in practice. And there are matadors who are starting their careers who still kill well, but are not yet proven or tested by time. But there is no outstanding matador who day in, day out kills well, easily, and with pride. The leading matadors have developed a facile and tricky way of killing, which has robbed what should be the culmination of the emotion of the bullfight of all emotion except that of disappointment. The emotion now is given by the cape, by occasionally the banderillas, most surely by the work with the muleta, and the best you can hope for from the sword is a quick ending that will not spoil the effect of what has gone before. I believe I saw more than 50 bulls killed with various degrees of facility before I consciously saw one killed well. I had no complaint about the bullfight as it was. It was interesting enough, better than anything I had seen up to that time. But I thought the sword business was a not particularly interesting anticlimax. Still, knowing nothing about it, I thought perhaps it was really an anticlimax, and that the people who spoke and wrote highly of the killing of the bull in bullfighting were merely liars. My own standpoint was quite simple. I could see the bull had to be killed to make the bullfight. I was pleased that he was killed with a sword, for anything to be killed with a sword was a rare enough business. But the way that he was killed looked like a trick and gave me no emotion at all. This is the bullfight, I thought. The end is not so good. But perhaps that is part of it, and I do not understand it yet. Anyway, it is the best $2 worth I have ever had. Still, I remembered at the first bullfight I ever saw, before I could see it clearly, before I could even see what happened in the new, crowded, confused, white-jacketed beer vendor passing in front of you, two steel cables between your eyes and the ring below, the bull's shoulders smooth with blood, the banderillas clattering as he moved, and a streak of dust down the middle of his back, his horns solid looking like wood on top, thicker than your arm where they curved. I remembered in the midst of this confused excitement having a great moment of emotion when the man went in with the sword. But I could not see in my mind exactly what happened, and when on the next bull I watched closely, the emotion was gone and I saw it was a trick. I saw 50 bulls killed after that before I had the emotion again. But by then I could see how it was done, and I knew I had seen it done properly that first time. When you see a bull killed for the first time, if it is the usual run of killing, this is about how it will look. The bull will be standing square on his 4 feet, facing the man who will be standing about 5 yards away with his feet together, the muleta in his left hand and the sword in his right. The man will raise the cloth in his left hand to see if the bull follows it with his eyes. Then he will lower the cloth, hold it and the sword together, turn so that he is standing sideways toward the bull, make a twist with his left hand that will furl the cloth over the stick of the muleta, draw the sword up from the lowered muleta and sight along it toward the bull. His head, the blade of the sword and his left shoulder pointing toward the bull, the muleta held low in his left hand. You will see him draw himself taut and start toward the bull. And the next thing you will see is that he is past the bull, and either the sword has risen into the air and gone end over end, or you will see its red flannel-wrapped hilt, or the hilt and part of the blade sticking out from between the bull's shoulders or from his neck muscles, and the crowd will be shouting in approval or disapproval, depending on the manner in which the man has gone in and the location of the sword. That is all you will see of the killing. But the mechanics of it are these. Bulls are not killed properly by a sword thrust in the heart. The sword is not long enough to reach the heart if driven in where it should go, high up between the shoulder blades. It goes past the vertebra between the top of the ribs and, if it kills instantly, cuts the aorta. That is the end of a perfect sword thrust, and to make it, the man must have the good luck that the sword point should not strike either the spine or ribs as it goes in. No man can go toward a bull, reach over the top of his head if it is carried high, and put a sword in between his shoulders. The instant the bull's head is up, the sword is not long enough to reach from his head to his shoulders. For it to be possible for the man to put the sword into the place where it is designed to go to kill the bull, he must have the bull's head down so that this place is exposed, and even then the man must lean forward over the bull's lowered head and neck to get the sword in. Now if, when the bull raises his head as the sword goes in, the man is not to go up in the air, one of two things must be happening. Either the bull must be in motion past the man, guided by the muleta in the man's left arm as he shoves the sword in with his right, or else the man must be in motion past the bull, who is guided away from the man by the muleta held by the left hand, which is crossed low in front of and to the left of the man's body as he goes in over the bull's head and comes out along his flank. Killing can be tricked by having both the man and bull in motion. These are the mechanical principles of the two ways to kill bulls properly. Either the bull must come to and pass the man, sighted, drawn on, controlled, and going out and away from the man by a movement of the muleta while the sword is being inserted between his shoulders, or else the man must fix the bull in position, his front feet together and his hind feet square with them, his head neither too high nor too low, must test him by raising and lowering the cloth to see if he follows it with his eyes, and then, with the muleta in his left hand, making a cross in front of him, so that if the bull follows it, he will pass to the man's right, go in toward the bull, and as he lowers his head after the cloth, which is to guide him away from the man, put the sword in and come out along the bull's flank. When the man awaits the charge of the bull, it is called killing recibiendo. When the man goes in on the bull, it is called a volapie, or flying with the feet. Preparing to go in, left shoulder toward the bull, sword pointed along the man's body, muleta held furled in the left hand, is called profiling. The closer it is done to the animal, the less chance the man has to deviate and escape if the bull does not follow the cloth as the man goes in. The movement made to swing the left arm holding the muleta, which is crossed in front of the body, out and past the right side to get rid of the bull, is called crossing. Anytime the man does not make this cross, he will have the bull under him. Unless he swings him far enough out, the horn is certain to catch him. To make this cross successfully necessitates a wrist movement which will swing the folds of the furled muleta out and to the side, as well as a simple arm movement across and away from the body. Bullfighters say that a bull is killed more with the left hand, which controls the muleta and guides the animal, than with the right, which shoves in the sword. There is no great force needed to put in the sword if the point does not strike bone. Properly guided by the muleta, if the man leans after the blade, the bull will seem sometimes to pluck the sword out from his hand. Other times, hitting bone, it will seem as though he had struck a wall of rubber and cement. In the old days, bulls were killed recibiendo, the matador provoking and awaiting the final charge, and those bulls which were too heavy on their feet to charge were hamstrung with a half-moon-shaped blade attached to a long pole, and then killed with a dagger stroke between the vertebrae of the neck after they were helpless. This repugnant business was made unnecessary by the invention of the volapie by Joaquin Rodriguez, called costillares, toward the end of the 18th century. The killing of a bull recibiendo. The man, now standing still and erect, his feet only a little apart after he has provoked the charge by bending one leg forward and swinging the muleta toward the bull, letting the bull come until man and bull become one figure as the sword goes in. Then the figure broken by the shock of the encounter, there coming a moment when they are joined by the sword that seems to slip in an inch at a time, is the most arrogant dealing of death and is one of the finest things you can see in bullfighting. You may never see it because the volapie, dangerous enough when properly executed, is so much less dangerous than the suerte de recibir that only very rarely does a fighter ever receive a bull in our times. I have seen it properly completed only 4 times in over 1,500 bulls I have seen killed. You will see it attempted, but unless the man really waits out the encounter and gets rid of the bull with an arm and wrist movement rather than by tricking with a sidestepping at the end, it is no receiving. Maera did it, Nino de la Palma did it once in Madrid and faked it several times, and Luis Frey did it. Few bulls come now to the end of a fight in proper condition to be received, but there are even fewer fighters to receive them. One reason for the decadence of this form of killing is that if the bull leaves the cloth as he reaches the man, the horn wound will be in the chest. In fighting with a cape, the first wound or catching will usually be in the lower leg or thigh. Where the second one is, if the bull passes the man from one horn to another, is a matter of luck. In the muleta, or in killing by the volapie, the wound is nearly always in the right thigh, as that is where the bull's horn passes when it is lowered, although a man who has gone well over the horn may be caught under the arm, or even at the neck, if the bull raises his head before the man has passed him. But in killing recibiendo, if anything goes wrong, the horn chop hits the chest. And so you hardly ever see it attempted anymore, except by someone who has drawn such a fine bull and done such a splendid faena that at the end he wants to make a super emotional climax, so he tries to kill recibiendo and usually he has used his bull up with the muleta, or else the man lacks the experience to receive properly, and the faena ends in an anticlimax or in a goring. The volapie, if properly executed, that is, slowly, closely, and well-timed, is a fine enough way to kill. I have seen bullfighters gored in the chest, have heard the rib crack, literally with the shock, and seen a man turn on the horn, with the horn in him and out of sight, muleta and sword in the air, then on the ground, the bull thrusting head and man high, and the man not leaving the horn when he is tossed, to come off the next toss into the air and be caught by the other horn and come down, try to get up, put his hands where he was breathing through his chest, and be carried with his teeth knocked out to die within an hour in the infirmary, still in his clothes, the wound too big to do anything with. I have seen that man's, Isidoro Toro's, face while he was in the air, he being fully conscious all of the time on the horn, and after, and able to talk in the infirmary before he died, although the blood in his mouth made his words unintelligible. So I see the bullfighter's viewpoint about killing recibiendo when they know the cornada comes in the chest. According to historians, Pedro Romero, who was a matador in Spain at the time of the American Revolution, killed 5,600 bulls recibiendo between the years of 1771 and 1779, and lived to die in his bed at the age of 95. If this is true, we live in a very decadent time indeed, when it is an event to see a matador even attempt to receive a bull. But we do not know how many bulls Romero would have lived to receive if he had tried to pass them as close as Juan Belmonte with the cape and muleta. Nor do we know how many of those 5,000 he received well, waiting quietly and getting the sword in high up between the shoulders, or how many he received badly, sidestepping and letting the sword go into the neck. Historians speak highly of all dead bullfighters. To read any history of the great fighters of the past, it would seem impossible that they ever had bad days or that the public was ever dissatisfied with them. It may be that they were never dissatisfied with them before 1873, because I have not had time to read the contemporary account any farther back than that. But since that time, bullfighting has always been considered by contemporary chroniclers to be in a period of decadence. During what you now hear referred to as the golden age of all golden ages, that of Lagartijo and Frascuelo, which really was a golden age, there was a generally expressed opinion that things were in a bad way. The bulls were much smaller and younger, or else they were big and they were cowardly. Lagartijo was no killer, Frascuelo, yes, but he was mean as dirt to his cuadrilla and impossible to get along with. Lagartijo was chased from the ring by the crowd on his final performance in Madrid. When in the accounts we come to Guerrita, another Golden Age hero who corresponds to the period just before, during, and after the Spanish-American War, you read that the bulls are small and young again. Gone are the giant animals of phenomenal bravery of the days of Lagartijo and Frascuelo. Guerrita is no Lagartijo, we read. It is sacrilege to compare the two, and this florid monkey business makes those who remember the serious honesty, no longer ugly meanness, of Frascuelo turn in their graves. El Espartero is no good and proves it by getting killed. Finally, Guerrita retires and everyone is relieved. They have had enough of him. Although once the great Guerrita is gone, bullfighting is in a profound depression. The bulls, oddly enough, have gotten smaller and younger, or if they are big, they are cowardly. Mafantini is no good. He kills still, yes, but not recibiendo, and he cannot get out of his own way with a cape and is a loss with the muleta. Fortunately, he retires, and once the great Don Luis Mafantini is gone, the bulls get smaller and younger, although there are a few huge cowardly ones more fit to draw carts than for the ring, and with that colossus of the sword disappeared, gone, alas, with Guerrita, the master of masters, such newcomers as Ricardo Bombita, Machaquito, and Rafael El Gallo, none of them anything but a fake, dominate the bull business. Bombita masters bulls with the muleta and has a pleasant smile, but he cannot kill as Mafantini killed. Gallo is ridiculous, an insane gypsy. Machaquito is brave but ignorant.
Only his luck saves him, and the fact that the bulls are so much younger and smaller than those giant, always brave animals of the time of Lagartijo and Salvador Sanchez, Frascuelo, now always called the Negro.
Affectionately, rather than as an insult, and beloved for his kindness to all. Vicente Pastor is honorable and brave in the ring, but he gives a little jump when killing and is frightened sick before he goes in to fight. Antonio Fuentes is still elegant, a beautiful performer with the sticks and a nice style killing, and that lets him out since who wouldn't be elegant working with the bulls that are nowadays so much younger and smaller than in the time of those faultless Colossi Lagartijo, Frascuelo, the heroic Aspartero, the ruler of Masters Guerrita, and that pinnacle of swordsmanship, Don Luis Mafantini. In this epoch, incidentally, when Don Indalecio Mosquera promoted the Madrid ring and cared nothing about bullfights but only about the size of the bulls, statistics show the bulls were consistently the biggest that were ever fought in Madrid. Along about this time, Antonio Montes got himself killed in Mexico, and it was at once realized that he had been the real fighter of his era. Serious and masterly, always giving them their money's worth, Montes was killed by a hollow-flanked, long-necked little Mexican bull that lifted his head instead of following the muleta when the sword went in, and as Montes turned and tried to swing out of the cradle of the horns, the bull's right horn caught him between the cheeks of his rump, lifted him, and carried him as though he was seated on a stool. The horn had gone in out of sight for 4 yards and then fell dead from the sword thrust. Montes lived 4 days after the accident. Then comes Joselito, who when he appeared was called Pasos Largos, or Big Jumps, and was attacked by all the admirers of Bombita, Machaquito, Fuentes, and Vicente Pastor, who fortunately all retired, and at once became incomparable. Guerrita said if you wanted to see Belmonte, see him in a hurry, because he won't last. No man can work so close to bulls. When he kept working closer and closer, it was discovered that the bulls were, of course, parodies of the giant animals he, Guerrita, had killed. Joselito was admitted to be very good in the press, but it was pointed out that he was only able to place banderillas on one side, the right. The bulls, of course, were very small. He insisted on that, that he killed holding the sword so high that some said he pulled it out of his hat, and others that he merely used it as a prolongation of his nose. And, this is Christ's truth, he was hooted, whistled at, and had cushions thrown at him the last day he fought in Madrid, the 15th of May, 1920, while he was working his second bull, after having cut the ear of his first, and was hit in the face by a cushion, while the crowd shouted, "Que se vaya! Que se vaya!" which can be translated, "May he get the hell out of here and stay." The next day, the 16th of May, he was killed in Talavera de la Reina, gored through the lower abdomen so his intestines came out, and he was unable to hold them in with both hands, but died of traumatic shock from the force of the cornada while the doctors were working on the wound, and his face composed very peacefully on the operating table after he was dead, with his brother-in-law having his picture taken holding a handkerchief to his eyes, and a crowd of wailing gypsies outside with more coming, and Gallo wandering around outside very pitiful, afraid to go in to see his brother dead, and Alamendro, the banderillero, saying, "If they can kill this man, I tell you, none of us is safe, none of us." And at once became in the press, and remains, the greatest bullfighter of all time, greater than Guerrita, Frascuelo, Lagartijo, according to the same men who, while he lived, attacked him. Belmonte retired and became greater than Jose even, returned after Maera died, and was discovered to be an exploiter of a formerly great name, avid for money. He did have his bulls selected that year, fought one more year. I swear this was the best he ever had. He fought all bulls, made no specifications on size, and triumphed along the whole line, including killing, which he had never truly mastered before, and was attacked the whole season in the press. He retired again after a nearly mortal horn wound, and all contemporary accounts agree he is the greatest living bullfighter. So, there you have it. And I will not know how Pedro Romero was until I shall have read the contemporary accounts before, during, and after, and I doubt very much if enough of these exist, even in letters, to enable a true judgment to be formed. From all the different sources I have read and all contemporary accounts, the epoch of biggest bulls and true golden age in Madrid was that of Lagartijo and Frascuelo, who were the greatest bullfighters of the last 60 years until Joselito and Belmonte. Garritas was no golden age, and he was responsible for introducing younger and smaller bulls. I've looked up the weights and the photographs. And in the 12 years that he fought, he had only one truly great year as a fighter, that of 1894. Big bulls were brought back during the epoch of Machaquito, Bombita, Pastor, and Gallo, and the size of the bulls was sensibly decreased during the golden age of Joselito and Belmonte, although they fought the biggest kind of bulls many times. At present, the bulls are big and old for the matadors without influence, and small and young whenever the bullfighter is powerful enough to have any hand or influence in their selection. Bulls are always big as they can be bred at Bilbao, in spite of the matadors, and usually the Andalusian breeders send their biggest and finest bulls to the July fair at Valencia. I have seen Belmonte and Marcial Alanda triumph in Valencia with bulls as large as any ever fought in the history of that ring. This historical summary started with regrets for the disappearance of the killing of the bulls Recibiendo, which, to recapitulate, disappeared because it is not taught nor practiced, since the public does not demand it, and since it is a difficult thing which must be practiced, understood, and dominated, and is much too dangerous to be improvised. If it were practiced, it could be performed readily enough if the bulls were allowed to reach the end of the fight in proper condition for it. But any suerte which can be approximated in bullfighting by another almost equal in public appeal and with less chance of death if its execution goes wrong, will surely die out in bullfighting unless the public demands that fighters perform it. The volapie, to be properly executed, demands that the bull be heavy on his feet and that he have his two front feet on a line and together. If he has one foot farther forward than the other, the top of one shoulder will be moved forward, and the opening through which the sword must go, and which is shaped rather like that between the palm of your hands if you place them with fingertips touching and wrists a little way apart, will be closed just as that between your hands will close if you bring the wrist of one hand forward. If the bull's feet are spread wide, this opening is narrowed by the shoulder blades being forced together, and if the feet are not together, it is closed entirely. It is through this opening that the point of the sword must enter to penetrate into the body cavity, and it will only continue on in if it does not strike a rib or the spine. In order to make it have a better chance of going in and taking a downward course in the direction of the aorta, the tip of the sword is curved so that it dips down. If the man goes in to kill the bull from in front with his left shoulder forward, if he puts the sword in between the shoulder blades, he will automatically come within reach of the bull's horns. In fact, his body must pass over the horn at the moment of putting in the sword. If his left hand, crossed in front of him and holding the muleta almost to the ground, does not keep the bull's head down until the man has passed over the horn and come out along the bull's flank, the man will be gored. To avoid this moment of very great danger to which the man exposes himself each time he kills a bull according to the rules, bullfighters who wish to kill without exposition profile at a considerable distance from the bull so that the bull, seeing the man coming in, will be in motion himself, and the man running across the line of the bull's charge with his right arm forward rather than his left shoulder tries to drive the sword in without ever letting his body come within range of the horn. The way that I have just described is the most flagrant form of bad killing. The farther forward in the bull's neck the sword is put in, and the lower down at the side, the less the man exposes himself, and the surer he is of killing the bull, since the sword is driven into the chest cavity, the lungs, or cuts the jugular or other veins, or the carotid or other arteries of the neck, all of which can be reached by the point of the sword without the man exposing himself to the slightest danger. It is for this reason that a killing is judged by the place in which the sword is put in and by the manner in which the man goes in to kill, rather than by the immediate results. To kill the bull with a single sword thrust is of no merit at all unless the sword is placed high between the bull's shoulders, and unless the man passed over and had his body within reach of the horn at the moment he went in. Many times in southern France, and occasionally in provinces in Spain where they have few bullfights, I have seen a matador applauded enthusiastically because he killed his bull with a single entry when the killing was no more than a riskless assassination, the man having never exposed himself at all, but merely slipped the sword into an unprotected and vulnerable spot. The reason the man is required to kill the bull high up between the shoulders is because the bull is able to defend that place and will only uncover it and make it vulnerable if the man brings his body within range of the horn, provided he enters according to the rules. To kill a bull in his neck or his flank, which he cannot defend, is assassination. To kill him high up between the shoulders demands risk by the man and studied ability if great danger is to be avoided. If the man uses this ability to make the proper execution of the entry with the sword as secure as possible, exposing his body but protecting it through his skill with his left hand, then he is a good killer. If he uses his ability merely to trick the killing so that he gets enough of the sword into the correct place to kill without ever exposing his body, then he is an able remover of bulls, but no matter how quickly or how securely he kills them off, he is no killer. The truly great killer is not the man who is simply brave enough to go in straight on the bull from a short distance and get the sword in somehow high between the shoulders, but is a man who is able to go in from a short distance, slowly, starting with the left foot and being so skillful in the management of his left hand that as he goes in, left shoulder forward, he makes the bull lower his head and then keeps it down as he goes over the horn, pushes in the sword, and as it is in, goes out along the bull's flank. The great killer must be able to do this with security and with style, and if, as he goes in left shoulder first, the sword strikes bone and refuses to penetrate, or if it strikes ribs or the edge of the vertebra and is deviated so that it goes in only a third of the way, the merit of the attempt at killing is as great as though the sword had gone all the way in and killed, since the man has taken the risk and the result has only been falsified by chance. A little over a third of the sword properly placed will kill a bull that is not too big. Half a sword will reach the aorta on any bull there is, if the sword is directed properly and placed high enough up. Many bullfighters, therefore, do not follow the sword all the way with their body, but only try to slip in half of the blade, knowing it will account for the bull if in the right spot, and realizing they themselves are much safer if they do not have to push in that last foot and a half. This practice of skillfully administering half estocades, originated by Lagartijo, is what has robbed killing of its emotion, since the beauty of the moment of killing is that flash when the man and bull form one figure as the sword goes all the way in, the man leaning after it, death uniting the two figures in the emotional, aesthetic, and artistic climax of the fight. That flash never comes in the skillful administering of half a blade to the bull. Martial Lalande is the most skillful of present matadors at getting the sword in, holding it high up on a level with his eyes as he sights, taking one or more backward steps before he starts the voyage in, and with the point of the blade tilted up, he enters, avoids the horn skillfully, and leaves the sword nearly always perfectly placed, yet without there having been the least exposition or emotion in the killing. He can kill well, too. I have seen him execute the volapiés perfectly. But he gives them their money's worth in the other departments of the fight, and relies on his ability to remove the bull from in front of him speedily, so that the memory of how good he was with Cape Banderillas and Muleta will not be spoiled. His ordinary manner of killing, as I have described it, is a sorry parody of what killing can be. From much reading of contemporary accounts, I believe Marcial Lalande's case, not his early trials, but his present continuous mastery, his philosophy of the bullfight, and his manner of killing, are very comparable to the middle period of the great Lagartijo, though Lalande certainly cannot compare with the grace, style, and naturalness of the Cordovan. But no one can be the present Lalande's superior in mastery. I believe 10 years from now, people will be referring to the years 1929, 1930, 1931 as the golden age of Marcial Lalande. Now he has as many enemies as any great bullfighter attracts, but he is unquestionably the master of all present fighters. Vicente Barrera kills in worse style than Lalande, but he has a different system. Instead of having a skillful way of placing half a blade in the correct spot, he relies on a tricky entry to place part of the blade anywhere above the neck, thus complying with the law which requires at least one entry by the matador, in order that having gone in once, he may kill the bull with a descabello. He is the living virtuoso of the descabello, which is a push with the point of the sword between the cervical vertebra to cut the spinal cord, supposedly for a use as a coup de grace on a bull which is dying and is too far gone to follow the muleta with his eyes, thus preventing the matador from going in another time to kill. Barrera uses his first entry, required by law of every matador according to the regulations of bullfighting, simply to try his luck at getting the sword in without exposing himself in any way. No matter what the effect of this sword thrust, Barrera plans to kill the live bull with a descabello. He relies on his footwork, tricks the bull with the muleta into lowering his muzzle and exposing the spot between the vertebra at the base of his skull, while he raises the sword slowly from behind him, bringing it high over his head, keeping it carefully out of sight of the bull, and then, with it poised point down, controlled by the wrist and with the precision of a juggler, he drives it down and severs the spinal marrow, dropping the bull dead as suddenly as an electric light is extinguished by the pushing of a button. Barrera's method of killing, while it keeps within the letter of the rules, is the negation of the whole spirit and tradition of the bullfight. The descabello, which is administered by surprise as a coup de grace designed to avoid the suffering of an animal which can no longer defend itself, is used by him to assassinate live bulls that he is supposed to expose his body to in killing with the sword. He has developed such a deadly precision in its use, and the public know from experience that nothing will influence him to expose a hair in killing, that they have come to tolerate his abuse of the descabello, and even sometimes to applaud it. To applaud him for cheating in the killing because he performs a trick with skill, assurance, and security that is made safe by his sureness in his footwork before the bull and ability to make a live bull lower his head as though he were dying is about as low as the mentality of a bullring public can go. Manolo Bienvenida is the worst at killing of any of the first series of matadors except Cagancho. Both of these make no pretense of observing the rules in killing and usually go in running on a bias to stab the bull with the sword with less exposing of themselves than a banderillero suffers in putting in the banderillas. I have never seen Bienvenida kill a bull well, and only twice in 24 times in 1931 did I see him kill a bull even decently. His cowardice at the moment of killing is disgusting. Cagancho's cowardice when he has to kill is more than disgusting. It is not the sweating, dry-mouthed fear of the 19-year-old boy who cannot kill properly, having been too frightened of it with big bulls ever to take the chances necessary to attempt it in order to learn to dominate it properly, and so is sick afraid of the horn. It is a cold-blooded, gypsy defrauding of the public by the most shameless, anger-arousing obtainer of money under false pretenses that ever went into a bull ring. Cagancho can kill well. He has height, which makes killing much easier, and any time he wants to, he can kill competently, well, and with good style. But Cagancho never takes a chance on performing anything that he thinks might cost him a horn wound. Killing is admittedly dangerous, even to a great killer. Therefore, Kagancho, sword in hand, will not let his body come within range of the bull's horn unless he has become convinced that the bull is candid and inoffensive and will follow the cloth as though his muzzle were glued to it. If Kagancho has proved to his satisfaction that the bull offers him no danger, he will kill with style, grace, and absolute security. If he believes there is the faintest danger, he will not let his body approach the horn. His cynical cowardice is the most disgusting negation of bullfighting that can be seen, worse even than the panic of Niño de la Palma, for Niño de la Palma no longer can execute his passes correctly. He is altogether unnerved by his fear, while nearly everything that Kagancho does when he is confident could serve as a model and illustration of perfection in artistic bullfighting. He only performs, however, if he is certain that there is no danger to a man working with the bull. Not that the chances are all in the man's favor. That is not enough for him. He does not take chances. He must be certain in his own mind that danger does not exist, or he will flop a cape from 2 yards away, wave the spike end of a muleta, and assassinate with a side-running stab. He will do this to bulls which are not criminal or even particularly dangerous to a matador with average ability and good courage. He has not the courage of a louse, since his amazing physical equipment, his knowledge, and his technique permit him to be much safer in the bull ring than anyone is crossing a street in traffic, provided he attempts nothing close to the bull. A louse takes chances in the seams of your garments. It may turn out that you are in a war and eventually be deloused, or you may hunt the louse down with a thumbnail. But you cannot delouse Kagancho. If there were any commission to regulate bullfighters and suspend matadors as faking boxers are occasionally deprived of their licenses when their political protection is inadequate, Kagancho might be eliminated from the bull rings, or he might, through fear of the commission, become a great bullfighter. The one really great fight that Manolo Bienvenida made in all of 1931 was the last day at Pamplona, when he was more afraid of the public and their anger at his previous cowardly performances than he was of the bulls. He had asked the governor for troops to protect him before the fight, and the governor told him if he went into the ring and performed well, he would need no protection. Each night at Pamplona, Manolo had been on the long-distance telephone hearing news of the chopping down of trees on his father's ranch by the peasant Jacquery in Andalusia. Groves of trees being cut down and charcoal burning started, pigs and chickens killed, cattle driven off. The ranch, which was not yet paid for and which he was fighting bulls to complete the payment on, being gradually pillaged in the sound agrarian sabotage plan of the Andalusian revolt, and being 19 years old and hearing his world destroyed over the telephone each night, he was worried enough. But the boys at Pamplona and the peasants from the country around who were spending their savings to see bullfights and not seeing them through the cowardice of matadors could not go into the economic causes of a matador's abstraction and lack of interest in his work, and they rioted against Manolo so violently and so scared him that finally, afraid of being lynched, he gave a splendid afternoon on the last day of the fair. If there was a penalty of suspension from his profitable business operations, Kagancho might give a good afternoon oftener. His excuse is that he runs danger and the spectator does not. But one is being paid proportionately and the other is paying. And when the spectators protest is when Kagancho refuses to run danger. True, he has been gored, but each time through an accident such as a sudden gust of wind that left him uncovered when he was working close to a bull that he believed safe. There is the one chance he cannot eliminate, and after he comes back to the ring from the hospital, he will not even come close to a bull he believes to be harmless, since there is no guarantee the wind will not blow up while he is working, or the cape get caught between his legs, or that he might not step on the cape, or even that the bull may not go blind. He is the only bullfighter I have been glad to see gored. But goring him is no solution, since he behaves much worse on coming out of the hospital than before he went in. Yet he keeps on having contracts and robbing the public because they know that when he wishes, he can do a complete and splendid faena, a model of perfect execution, and end it by killing beautifully. The best killer today is Nicanor Bialta, who started in by tricking his killing, using his height to lean over the bull as he blinded him with his huge muleta, and has now so purified, so mastered, and so perfected the art that, in Madrid at least, he kills nearly every bull he faces closely, confidently, correctly, securely, and emotionally, having learned the way to profit by his magic left wrist, really to kill, instead of merely tricking. Vialta is an example of the simple man that I spoke of at the beginning of this chapter. In intelligence and in conversation, he is not as smart as your 12-year-old sister if she is a backward child, and he has a sense of glory and belief in his greatness that you could reach high enough to hang your hat upon. Added to this, he has a semi-hysterical bravery that no cold valor can compete with in intensity. Personally, I find him insufferable, although he is pleasant enough if you do not mind conceited hysteria. But with sword and muleta in Madrid, he is the bravest, most secure, and most consistent and emotional killer in Spain today. The best swordsmen in my time were Manuel Barre, called Barrelito, probably the best killer of my generation, Antonio de la Haba, called Zurito, Martín Aguero, Manolo Martínez, and Luis Frey. Barrelito was of moderate stature, simple, sincere, and a consistently great killer. Like all killers of only moderate height, he took more punishment from the bulls. Not yet recovered from the effects of a horn wound received the year before, he was unable to kill with his old style in the April fair in Seville in 1922, and his work unsatisfactory, the crowd jeered and insulted him all through the fair. Turning his back on a bull after he had put the sword in, the bull caught him and gave him a terrific wound near the rectum that perforated the intestines. It was almost the same wound that Sidney Franklin received and recovered from in the spring of 1930, and it was the same sort of wound that killed Antonio Montes. He, Barrelito, being gored late in April, lived until May 13th. As they were carrying him down the passageway around the ring to the infirmary, the crowd, which had been hooting him a minute before, now murmuring with the rush of talk that always follows a serious cogida. Barrelito kept saying, looking up at them, "Now you've given it to me. Now I've got it. Now you've given it to me. Now you've got what you wanted. Now I've got it. Now you've given it to me. Now I've got it. Now I've got it. I've got it." He had it, although it took nearly 4 weeks for it to kill him. Zurito was the son of the last and one of the greatest of the old-time picadors. He was from Córdoba, dark and rather thin, his face very sad in repose, serious and with a deep sense of honor. He killed classically, slowly and beautifully, with a sense of honor that forbade him to use any advantage or trick, or to deviate from a straight line as he went in. He was one of four novilleros who were sensations in their class in 1923 and 1924, and when the other three, who were all much riper than he, though none of them were very ripe, became matadors, he became one himself at the very end of the season, although his apprenticeship, in the sense that an apprenticeship should continue until the craft has been mastered, was not finished. None of the four had served a proper apprenticeship. Manuel Baez, called Litri, the most sensational of the four, was a prodigy of valor and wonderful reflexes, but insensate in his bravery and very ignorant in his fighting. He was a brown-faced, bow-legged little boy with black hair, a face like a rabbit, and a nervous tick of vision which made his eyelids wink as he watched the bull come. But for a year he substituted bravery, luck, and reflexes for knowledge. And while he was tossed literally hundreds of times, he was often so close to the horn that it could not get a good chop at him, and his luck saved him from all but one serious horn wound. We all spoke of him as carne de toro, or meat for the bulls. and it really did not make much difference when he took the alternative, since he fought on a nervous valor that could not last, and with his faulty technique he was certain to be destroyed by a bull, and the more money he made before it happened, the better. He was fatally wounded in the first fight of the year in Malaga, early in February of 1926, after he had been a matador one full season. He need not have died of that wound if it had not become infected with gaseous gangrene, and his leg amputated too late to save his life. The bullfighters say, "If I must be gored, let it be in Madrid." Or if they are Valencian, they substitute Valencia for Madrid, since it is in those two cities that there are most serious bullfights, therefore most horn wounds, and consequently, two of the greatest specialists in that surgery. There is no time for a specialist to come from one city to another for the most vital part of a wound treatment, which is the opening and cleaning to avoid the possibility of infections of all the multiple trajectories a horn wound makes. I have seen a horn wound in the thigh with an opening no larger than a silver dollar, which when probed and opened inside had as many as 5 different trajectories, these being caused by the man's body revolving on the horn and sometimes by the end of the horn being splintered. All of these inner wounds must be opened and cleaned, and at the same time, all incisions in the muscle must be made, so that it will heal in the minimum of time and with the least possible loss of mobility. A bullring surgeon has 2 aims: to save the man, the aim of ordinary surgery, and to place the torero back in the ring as soon as possible in order that he may fulfill contracts. It is his ability to get the fighter back to work rapidly that makes a horn wound specialist able to command high fees. It is a very special sort of surgery, but its simplest form, which is the caring for the ordinary wound, which comes oftenest between knee and groin or between knee and ankle, since that is where the bull's lowered horns catch the man in goring, is to ligate the femoral artery with promptness if it has been opened, and then find, with the finger usually, or with a probe, open and clean all the various trajectories which a horn wound may have, at the same time keeping the patient's heart going with camphor injections and replacing the lost blood with injections of normal salt solution and so forth. Anyway, Litri's leg infected in Malaga and they amputated it, having promised him when he was anesthetized it was only to clean the wound. And when he was conscious and found the leg gone, he did not want to live and was in great despair. I was very fond of him and wished he might have died without the amputation, since he was marked to die anyway when he took the alternative and was certain to be destroyed as soon as his luck ran out. Torito never had any luck. His apprenticeship uncompleted, he had the shortest kind of repertoire with Cape and Muleta, the latter consisting principally of passes por alto and the easily learned trick of the molinete, and the excellence of his swordsmanship and the purity of his style with the sword were obscured by the hair-raising campaign Litri was making and the great season Niño de la Palma had. Torito had 2 good seasons after Litri's death, but before he ever had a chance to really become a dominating figure. His work was old-fashioned, since he made no improvement with the cape and muleta, and as he always aimed the sword from the very top of the opening between the shoulder blades, and going in so high with his left shoulder forward, it was difficult to keep the muleta low enough to get rid of the bull completely, he took much punishment from the bulls, especially those terrible blows from the flat of the horn against the chest, with which the bulls lifted him off his feet nearly every time he killed. Then he almost lost a season from internal injuries and a growth of some sort that came on his lip where it had been hurt. In 1927, he was fighting in such bad physical condition that it was tragic to watch him. He knew that to lose out on a single season may put a bullfighter in the discard, so that he will have only 2 or 3 fights a year and not be able to make a living. And all that season, Torito was fighting. His face, that had been a healthy brown, now was as gray as weathered canvas, so short of breath that it was pitiful to see him, yet attacking as straight, as close, and with the same classic style and the same bad luck. When the bull bumped him off his feet or gave him one of those palatazos, or strokes with the flat of the horn that the bullfighters claim harm as much as wounds since they cause internal hemorrhages, he would faint from weakness, be carried into the infirmary, brought to, and come out again, weak as a convalescent, to kill his other bull. Due to his style of killing, he was bumped nearly every time he killed. He fought 21 times, fainted dead away in 12 of them, and killed all of his 42 bulls. It was not enough, though, because his work with the cape and muleta, never stylish, in the condition he was in, was not even competent, and the publics did not like to see him faint. There was an editorial against it in the San Sebastian paper. That was the town where he had been most successful, and they did not contract him again since his fainting was very repugnant to foreigners and the best people. So that season in which he gave the most harrowing display of courage I have ever seen did him no good. He married at the end of it. She wanted to marry him, they said, before he died. And instead he got much better. He became rather fat, and loving his wife did not go in quite so straight on the bulls, and fought only 14 times. The next year he fought only 7 times in Spain and South America. The next year he was going in as straight as ever, but he had only 2 contracts in Spain for the whole year, not enough to support his family. Of course, his fainting that year was not pleasant to see, but he only knew one way to kill, and that was perfectly. And if in attempting it the horn or the muzzle struck him and he lost the consciousness of this world, that was his hard luck, and he always returned to fight as soon as he was conscious. The public did not like it. It became an old story so rapidly. I did not like it myself, but by Christ, how I admired it. Too much honor destroys a man quicker than too much of any other fine quality, and with a little bad luck, it ruined Zurito in 1 season. Old Zurito, the father, brought up 1 son to be a matador and taught him honor, technique, and classic style, and that boy is a failure in spite of great skill and integrity. He taught the other boy to be a picador, and he has a perfect style, great courage, is a splendid horseman, and would be the best picador in Spain but for 1 thing. He is too light to be able to punish the bulls. No matter how hard he pegs them, he can barely draw blood. So he, with the most ability and style of any picador living, is picking in noviadas at 50 to 100 pesetas apiece, when with 50 pounds more weight, he would be continuing the great tradition of the father. There is another son, too, who is a picador that I have not seen, but they tell me he, too, is too light. They are not a lucky family. Martin Aguero, the third of the killers, was a boy from Bilbao who did not look like a bullfighter at all, but more like a husky, well-built professional ball player, a third baseman or shortstop. He had a full-lipped face, German-American-looking in the sense that Nick Altrox was, and was no artist with cape or muleta, although he managed a cape well enough, sometimes excellently, understood bullfighting, was not ignorant, and did what he did with the muleta well, although he was altogether without artistic imagination. Put him down as a capable and close worker with the cape, and a competent but dull performer with the muleta. With the sword, he was a secure and rapid killer. His estocadas always looked wonderful in photographs, because the photograph does not give any sense of time. But when you watched him kill, he went in so lightning fast that even though he killed more securely than Zurito, crossing magnificently, and 9 times out of 10 getting the sword in all the way to the hilt, yet 1 escotada of Zurito's was worth many of Aguero's to watch, since Zurito went in so slowly and directly, marking the time of the killing so completely that there was no element of taking the bull by surprise. Aguero killed like a butcher boy, and Zurito like a priest at benediction. Aguero was very brave and very efficient, and was one of the leading matadors in 1925, 1926, and 1927, fighting 50 and 52 times in those last 2 years, and almost never being tossed. In 1928, he was gored severely twice. the second Cornada coming as a result of his fighting before he was in good shape after the first, and the two of them breaking down his fine health and physique. A nerve in one of his legs was so badly injured that it atrophied, and this led to gangrene of the toes of his right foot and an operation for their removal in 1931. The last I heard, his foot had been so mutilated that it was considered impossible that he would ever fight again. He leaves two younger brothers as novilleros with the same looks, the same athletic physique, and the beginnings of the same skill with the sword. Diego Mascaran, Fortuna of Bilbao, is another great killer of the butcher boy type. Fortuna is curly-haired, big-wristed, husky, swaggering, married much money, fights just enough to have money of his own, is brave as the bull himself and just a little less intelligent. He is the luckiest man that ever fought bulls. He knows only one way to work with a bull. He treats them as though they were all difficult and chops them and doubles them into position with the muleta, no matter what sort of faena they require. If the bull happens to be difficult, this is very satisfactory. But if he is asking for a grand faena, it is not. Once he gets their two front feet together, Fortuna furls the muleta, profiles with the sword, looks over his shoulder at his friends and says, "See if we can kill him this way," and goes in straight, strong, and well. He is so lucky that the sword may even cut the spinal marrow and drop the bull as though he was struck by lightning. If he is not lucky, he will sweat and his hair will get more frizzy. He will explain to the spectators with gestures the difficulties of the animal. Will call on them all to witness it is not his, Fortuna's, fault. The next day, in his regular seat in Tendido 2, he is one of the few bullfighters who attend bullfights regularly, when a really difficult bull comes out for some other fighter to handle, he will tell all the rest of us, "That's not a difficult bull. That bull is good. He ought to do something with that bull." Fortuna is really brave, though, brave and stupid. He has absolutely no nervousness about the fight. I have heard him say to a picador, "Come on, come on, hurry it up, I'm bored in here. The whole thing bores me, hurry it up." Among the fragile artists, he stands out as a survival from a different time. But he will bore you blinder than he ever has been bored in the ring if you sit near him for a season. Manolo Martinez of the barrio of Ruzafa in Valencia, slight, with his round eyes, his twisted, crooked face, his thin smile, looks as though he belonged around a racetrack or like one of the best of the tough citizens you knew around the pool rooms when you were a boy. Many critics deny he is a great killer because he has never had any luck in Madrid, and the editors of the French bullfight paper Le Toril, a very good periodical, deny him all merit because he has sense enough not to risk his life when fighting in the south of France, where any sword that disappears into the bull, no matter how placed or how trickily inserted, is universally applauded. Martinez is as brave as Fortuna, and he is never bored. He loves to kill, and he is not as conceited as Bialta is. When it comes out well, he is pleased, seemingly as much for you as for himself. He has been greatly punished by the bulls, and I saw him get a terrible cornada one year in Valencia. His work with cape and muleta is unsound, but if the bull is a frank, fast charger, Martinez works as close as any man can pass bulls. This day he had a bull that hooked to the right, and he seemingly did not notice the defect. The bull bumped him once in passing with the cape, and the next time Martinez passed him on the same side and did not give him room, he caught him with the horn and tossed him. He was unwounded. The horn had slid along the skin without catching and had only torn his trousers. But he had come down on his head and was groggy, and on his next turn with the cape, he took the bull all the way out into the center of the ring and there, alone, tried to pass him closely on the right side again. Of course, the bull caught him. His defect had been accentuated by his success at getting the man before, and this time the horn went in, and Martinez went into the air on the horn, the bull tossed him clear, and as he lay still on the ground, gored at him again and again before the other bullfighters running to the center of the ring could attract the bull away. As Manolo rose to his feet, he saw the blood pumping from his groin, and knowing the femoral artery was severed, he put both hands over it to try to contain the hemorrhage and ran as fast as he could for the infirmary. He knew his life was going out in that stream that spurted between his fingers, and he could not wait to be carried. They tried to grab him, but he shook his head. Dr. Serra came running down the passageway, and Martinez shouted to him, "Don Paco, I've got a big cornada." And with Dr. Serra pressing with his thumb to stop the artery, they went into the infirmary together. The horn had passed almost completely through his thigh. His loss of blood was so tremendous, and he was so weak and prostrated, no one believed he would live, and at one time, being unable to get any pulse, they announced he was dead. The destruction in the muscle was so great, no one thought he would be able to fight again if he lived. But being gored on the 31st of July, he was well enough to fight in Mexico on the 18th of October due to his constitution and the skill of Dr. Paco Serra. Martinez has suffered terrible horn wounds, rarely when killing, but usually from his desire to work close to bulls that will not permit it, and his fundamental unsoundness in handling the cape and muleta, and desire to keep his feet absolutely together when letting the bull pass. But his horn wounds only seem to refresh his valor. He is a local fighter. I have never seen him really good except in Valencia, but in 1927, in a fair that was built around Juan Belmonte and Marcial Alanda, and for which Martinez was not even contracted, when Belmonte and Marcial were gored, he came in to substitute and fought three fights in which he was superb, doing everything with cape and muleta so closely and dangerously, and taking such chances you could not believe it possible the bulls would not kill him. And then, when it was time to kill, profiling closely, arrogantly, rocking a little back on his heels to plant himself solidly, his left knee a little bent, settling his weight on the other foot, then going in and killing in a way no living man could better. In 1931, he was dangerously gored in Madrid and was still unrecovered when he fought in Valencia. The critics all say he is finished now, but he has made his living proving them wrong from the start, and I believe as soon as his nerves and muscles will obey his heart again, he will be the same as ever until a bull destroys him. With his unsoundness and inability to dominate a difficult bull, coupled to his great bravery, that seems inevitable. His valor is almost humorous. It is a sort of Cockney bravery. While Bialta's is conceited, Fortuna's is dumb, and Turito's is mystic. The valor of Luis Frege, he has no art except with the sword, is the strangest that I know. It is as indestructible as the sea, but there is no salt in it unless it is the salt of his own blood, and human blood has a sweet and sickly taste in spite of its saline quality. If Luis Frey had died in any of the four times that I remember him being given up as dead, I could write more freely of his character. He is a Mexican Indian, heavyset now, soft-voiced, soft-handed, nose rather hooked, slant-eyed, full mouth, very black hair, the only matador who still wears the pigtail plaited on his head, and he has been a full matador in Mexico since Johnson fought Jeffries at Reno, Nevada in 1910, and in Spain since the year after that fight. In the 21 years he has fought as a matador, the bulls have given him 72 severe horn wounds. No bullfighter who ever lived has been so punished by the bulls as he has. He has received extreme unction 5 different times when he was believed certain to die. His legs are as gnarled and twisted by scars as the branches of an old oak tree, and his chest and his abdomen are covered with scars of wounds that should have killed him. Most of them have come from his heaviness on his feet and his inability to control the bulls with cape and muleta. He was a great killer, though, slow, secure, and straight. And the few times, few in proportion to his other gorings, that he was wounded when killing were due to his lack of speed of foot to come out from between the horns and along the flank after he had the sword in, rather than to any defects in his technique. His terrible gorings, his months in the hospitals, which used up all his money, had no effect on his valor at all. But it was a strange valor. It never fired you. It was not contagious. You saw it, appreciated it, and knew the man was brave. But somehow it was as though courage was a syrup rather than a wine, or the taste of salt and ashes in your mouth. If qualities have odors, the odor of courage to me is the smell of smoked leather, or the smell of a frozen road, or the smell of the sea when the wind rips the top from a wave. But the valor of Louis Frey did not have that odor. It was clotted and heavy, and there was a thin part underneath that was unpleasant and oozy. And when he is dead, I will tell you about him, and it is a strange enough story. The last time he was given up for dead at Barcelona, torn open terribly, the wound full of pus, delirious and dying, everyone believed, he said,
"I see death. I see it clearly. Ay, it is an ugly thing."
He saw death clearly, but it did not come. He is broke now and giving a final series of farewell performances. He was marked for death for 20 years, and death never took him. There you have portraits of 5 killers. If we can synthesize from studying good killers, you might say that a great killer needs honor, courage, a good physique, a good style, a great left hand, and much luck. Then he needs a good press and plenty of contracts. The location and the effect of estocadas and the various manners of killing are described in the glossary. If the people of Spain have one common trait, it is pride. And if they have another, it is common sense. And if they have a third, it is impracticality. Because they have pride, they do not mind killing, feeling that they are worthy to give this gift. As they have common sense, they are interested in death and do not spend their lives avoiding the thought of it and hoping it does not exist, only to discover it when they come to die. This common sense that they possess is as hard and dry as the plains and mesas of Castile, and it diminishes in hardness and dryness as it goes away from Castile. At its best, it is combined with a complete impracticality. In the south, it becomes picturesque. Along the littoral, it becomes mannerless and Mediterranean. In the north, in Navarra and Aragon, there is such a tradition of bravery that it becomes romantic. And along the Atlantic coast, as in all countries bounded by a cold sea, life is so practical there is no time for common sense. Death to people who fish in the cold parts of the Atlantic Ocean is something that may come at any time, that comes often, and is to be avoided as an industrial accident, so that they are not preoccupied with it and it has no fascination for them. There are 2 things that are necessary for a country to love bullfights. One is that the bulls must be raised in that country, and the other that the people must have an interest in death. The English and the French live for life. The French have a cult of respect for the dead, but the enjoyment of the daily material things, family, security, position, and money are the things that are most important. The English live for this world, too, and death is not a thing to think of, to consider, to mention, to seek, or to risk except in the service of the country, or for sport, or for adequate reward. Otherwise, it is an unpleasant subject to be avoided, or at best moralized on, but never to be studied. Never discuss casualties, they say, and I have heard them say it very well. When the English kill, they kill for sport, and the French kill for the pot. It is a fine pot, too, the loveliest in the world, and well worth killing for. However, any killing which is not for the pot nor for sport seems to the English and the French to be cruel. Like all general statements, things are not as simple as I have written them, but I'm seeking to state a principle and refrain from listing exceptions. Now, in Spain, the bullfight is out of place in Galicia and in most of Catalonia. They do not raise bulls in those provinces. Galicia is beside the sea, and because it is a poor country where the men emigrate or go to sea, death is not a mystery to be sought and mediated on, but rather a daily peril to be avoided. And the people are practical, cunning, often stupid, often avaricious, and a favorite amusement is choral singing. Catalonia is Spain, but the people are not Spanish. And although bullfighting flourishes in Barcelona, it is on a fake basis because the public that attends goes as to a circus for excitement and entertainment and is as ignorant almost as the publics of Nîmes, Béziers, and Arles. The Catalans have a rich country, a great part of it at least. They are good farmers, good businessmen, good salesmen. They are the commercially elect of Spain. The richer the country, the simpler the peasantry, and they combine a simple peasantry and a childish language with a highly developed commercial class. With them, as in Galicia, life is too practical for there to be much of the hardest kind of common sense, nor much feeling about death. In Castile, the peasant has nothing of the simple-mindedness, combined as always with cunning, of the Catalan or Gallego. He lives in a country with as severe a climate as any that is farmed, but it is a very healthy country. He has food, wine, his wife and children, or he has had them, but he has no comfort nor much capital, and these possessions are not ends in themselves. They are only a part of life, and life is something that comes before death. Someone with English blood has written, "Life is real, life is earnest, and the grave is not its goal." And where did they bury him? And what became of the reality and the earnestness? The people of Castile have great common sense. They could not produce a poet who would write a line like that. They know death is the unescapable reality, the one thing any man may be sure of, the only security, that it transcends all modern comforts, and that with it, you do not need a bathtub in every American home, nor when you have it, do you need the radio. They think a great deal about death, and when they have a religion, they have one which believes that life is much shorter than death. Having this feeling, they take an intelligent interest in death, and when they see it being given, avoided, refused, and accepted in the afternoon for a nominal price of admission, they pay their money and go to the bull ring, continuing to go even when, for certain reasons that I have tried to show in this book, they are most often artistically disappointed and emotionally defrauded. Most of the great bullfighters have come from Andalusia, where the best bulls are raised, and where, with the warm climate and the Moorish blood, the men have a grace and indolence that is foreign to Castile, although they have, mixed with the Moorish blood, the blood of the men of Castile who drove out the Moors and occupied that pleasant country. Of the truly great fighters, both Cayetano Sanz and Frascuelo were from around Madrid, although Frascuelo was born to the south, as well as Vicente Pastor of the minor greats and Marcial Alanda, the best of the present fighters. There are fewer bullfights given all the time in Andalusia due to the agrarian troubles, and fewer first-rate matadors produced. In 1931, out of the first 10 matadors, there were only 3 from Andalusia, Cagancho and the 2 Bienvenidas, and Manolo Bienvenida, although of Andalusian parentage, was born and raised in South America, while his brother, although born in Spain, was also raised out of the country. Chicuelo and Niño de la Pama, representing Seville and Ronda, are both finished, and Gitanillo de Triana of Seville was killed. Marcial Lalanda is from near Madrid, as are Antonio Marquez, who will be fighting again, and Domingo Ortega. Bialta is from Zaragoza, and Barrera from Valencia, along with Manolo Martinez and Enrique Torres. Felix Rodriguez was born in Santander and raised in Valencia, and Almeida Chico, Solorzano, and Heriberto García are all Mexicans. Nearly all the leading young novilleros are from Madrid or from around Madrid, the north, or Valencia. Since the death of Joselito and Mayera and the final retirement of Belmonte, the reign of Andalusia in modern bullfighting has been over. The center of bullfighting in Spain now, both as to the production of fighters and the greatest enthusiasm for the fight itself, is Madrid and the country around Madrid. Valencia comes next. The most complete and masterly fighter in bullfighting today is unquestionably Marcial Lalanda, and the most complete young fighters in point of view of valor and technical equipment are being turned out in Mexico. The bullfight is undoubtedly losing ground in Seville, which once was with Cordoba its great center, and is undoubtedly gaining in Madrid, where all spring and early summer in 1931, in bad financial times, in a time of much political unrest and with only ordinary programs, the ring was filled to capacity two and sometimes three times a week. Judging from the enthusiasm I saw shown for it under the Republic, the modern bullfight will continue in Spain in spite of the great wish of her present European-minded politicians to see it abolished so that they will have no intellectual embarrassments at being different from their European colleagues that they meet at the League of Nations and at the foreign embassies and courts. At present, a violent campaign is being conducted against it by certain newspapers with government subsidies. But so many people derive their livings from the many ramifications of raising, shipping, fighting, feeding, and butchering of fighting cattle that I do not believe the government will abolish it even if they felt themselves strong enough. An exhaustive study is being made of the actual and potential use of all lands used for the grazing of fighting bull stock. In the agrarian readjustments that must come in Andalusia, some of the biggest ranches are sure to be broken up. But since Spain is a grazing as well as an agricultural country, and much of the grazing land is unfit for cultivation, and none of the cattle produced are wasted, all being butchered and sold, whether killed in the ring or the slaughterhouse,
much of the land now used for fighting bull grazing in the south will certainly be retained.
In a country where to give work to the agricultural laborers, all machines for harvesting and sowing had to be banned in 1931, the government will go slowly about putting much new land under cultivation. There is no question of trying to cultivate the grazing land used for bulls around Colmenar and Salamanca. I look for a certain reduction of acreage in bull-raising land in Andalusia and the breaking up of a number of ranches, but believe there will be no great change in the industry under the present government, although many of its members would be proud to abolish the bullfight and doubtless will do all they can toward that end, and the quickest way to get at it is through the bulls. Since bullfighters grow up unencouraged, having a natural talent as acrobats or jockeys or even riders have, and none of them are irreplaceable. But fighting bulls are the product of many generations of careful breeding as racehorses are. And when you send that strain to the slaughterhouse, that strain is finished.